Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Not until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Today, it's just one of those stories on Conversations. It begins nearly 10 years ago with the attack on the World Trade Center in New York in 2001. After that, the question was asked, here and elsewhere, just how good is our airport security anyway? And that's where Alan Kessing comes in. At that time, Alan Kessing was a senior customs official, and he was asked to pull together a bunch of internal reports into customs security at the airport, a place that he says has essentially become Australia's biggest shopping centre with a couple of runways attached to it. Alan Kessing had lifted up a great big rock, and what he saw, he says, was a picture of theft, smuggling and systemic criminality at the airport. Then he was asked to write a report focusing on the private security staff employed by the airport's corporation, and then another report into the so-called sterile areas of Sydney Airport, where you can't go in without an air security ID card. What followed from that is a story of how government and bureaucratic control freakery can undermine security at our airports, distort the judicial process, and drain every last cent from a man who tried to do the right thing. Alan Kessing, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you very much.
This is just one of those stories, Alan. It's unfolded over several years, and I've kind of been keeping an eye on it. It hasn't been front of mind for me. I've been going, oh, that doesn't sound too good. And it's only in the last couple of days when I've been looking at the whole story and the most recent revelations about this story that it makes me wonder. You should be a shambolic figure of moral outrage. You're not twitching. You look like a normal person at the moment.
Well, I guess I'm over that now. When this whole farrago began in 2005, or that is the charging of me, but I went through my periods of outrage and, sheer incandescent fury. I'm afraid I'm rather burned out now. My last real effort was in 2009 when I held a press conference, Senator Nick Xenophon arranged a press conference at Parliament House, and it was on, quite ironically and coincidentally, it was the sixth anniversary of the actual waste charging. And since then, I've heard virtually nothing. There's no movement on the pardon or anything else. So I just have forgotten about it in the last year. That's why I'm looking so, calm and relaxed, as you call it.
Yeah, but some further evidence has come to light, and we're going to eventually get to that, which changes it broadens and deepens the whole nature of the case, mm-hmm. I think. Let's go back to when you started working in customs. Now, you'd had a very eventful life before you returned to Australia. You'd been living all over the world. You returned to Australia. Why did you join customs?
I guess I needed a real job because my son was just entering university, and as people will know, teenagers are rather expensive little items, and just seemed like an honourable job that I could do well because of my experience abroad. I mean, I speak a couple of languages, I can read the world's major scripts, and it was a job I loved. Every moment of it, I loved every second of it.
Why?
Well, one, I was able to do something worthwhile and honourable, as I say. The mere fact that you know you're protecting Australia. I mean, one of our mottos is, protecting the border. And the border is a concept we use to simply mean everything from outside, we have to check it before it comes in and has an impact on the Australian public. And I just find I couldn't imagine a job I more wanted to do.
What was your first job in customs, Alan?
Oh, just on the wharves.
Just on the wharves?
Yeah. Traditionally wharves, ever since ships were invented, the wharves have been where the domestic scene interfaces with the international. And it's just what you see down there is beyond the belief of the most ordinary people. They would not believe what goes on, both good and bad, but mostly bad. I think I spent just over three years, nearly four, on the wharves. Became quite interested in the whole concept of what we now call screening, because in those days nobody had computers on their desks, and the commercial entity which ran the wharf had a commercial system for registering the containers, and I was able to work out a system using just the very, very basic facilities to screen cargo and what was in the containers.
Are smugglers, by and large, are they kind of savvy international operators and know exactly what they're doing, or are they mostly quite stupid?
Well, if they weren't as stupid as they are, we wouldn't get three quarters of the hits we do.
What examples have you got of that?
Honestly, I mean, we could spend the next week talking about it. Sometimes it's as silly as they've simply got drugs in their pocket or on their person or in their carry-on baggage. And this is where dogs do come into their own. Whilst you're standing up waiting to go through the passport line, you'll quite often see dogs coming by and they just walk them by you. And honestly, the number of hits we get just from something as silly as that. But the real worry or the real concern that should be addressed is the major smugglers, and they are almost entirely a cargo, and they are very well organised and very well established. I call them the old established, respectable, you know, importers, heroin importers, some of whom bring in such massive amounts of legitimate commercial material that effective control would mean holding up, you know, multi-million dollar shipments. And
that's not going to happen very often, is it?
There is a great reluctance to stop traffic, whether it's traffic of people or traffic of cargo, for commercial reasons.
So is that where you believe most of the heroin comes into Australia, rather than being, you know, flown in from New Guinea on a Cessna?
No, that's ludicrous. No.
It comes in through major container ships that it's embedded with large amounts of industrial goods, legitimate goods.
Correct, yes. By far, I mean, at one time back in the late 90s, there was so much heroin already in Australia that they were having to warehouse it simply to stop the price dropping. And all international studies show, and every law enforcement agency or customs agency in the world admits, they don't get more than 10%. And that's proved by simple supply and demand. The price of most powder drugs, heroin and cocaine, is lower in any Western country now than it was 20 years ago. Now, supply and demand suggests that there's plenty of supply and the demand hasn't dropped. And yes, there's no question that it comes in multi 100 kilo shipments via sea cargo. Air cargo is primarily cocaine, but that's only because of its origin, i.e. South America.
You joined the Air Border Security Unit. Mm-hmm. What was the nature of that work?
That was entirely devoted to behind the line, behind the sterile line. It was looking into all forms of criminality, involving everyone from the cleaners right up to, and not excluding, other customs and quarantine officers.
My guest in conversation, if you've just joined us, is Alan Kessing. Alan is a former customs official. After September 11, he wrote several damning reports into security at Sydney Airport. Those reports were shelved. Then someone leaked them to the Australian newspaper. The government brought the full force of the law to find the leaker, but Alan's always denied that he was the one who leaked the reports. Now new information has come to light which suggests that his trial was a miscarriage of justice. You were coming up for retirement. Why do you think you were asked to write that report, given that you were about to retire?
Well, having left the intel unit and returned to the airport in, I think it was 2001, as you say, coming up to retirement, and I was just on general duties, and an officer I knew who was in this unit knew of my previous work and asked me to specifically come in because that person knew of my experience, intel experience, and asked me to look over all the work that the covert unit had assembled over all the data they'd assembled over the previous, I think, nearly 10 years, which had never properly been scrutinised by an analyst with a background in further research, shall we say. So I looked over everything they'd done. It took about 3 months just to read and collate everything that had been acquired by this unit. This covert unit, the Air Border Security, was always able to conduct their own operations and had quite a success rate. But for every operation, you have any amount of information which is going to be pertinent to the next operation, shall we say, or one that didn't work out in the past. But because it was only a small unit, only half a dozen officers, and the workload was so huge, they were never able to properly do a post-seizure analysis. And I was asked specifically to do that, and I could easily say I did not get out of the office for about 3 months. I didn't even, set foot on the tarmac, which was our primary responsibility, simply reading through this material. And when I'd done so, I basically gave my overview of the information they'd already gathered to the officer who'd asked me to do so. And it was then decided that because it was clear that that unit was going to be disbanded, that officer asked me to produce the two reports, which have since become famous.
You mentioned there that the unit was about to be disbanded. Do you think that's what prompted the need to create this report, to sort of show that you could actually do this work and you guys were on the case?
That was certainly my understanding. A new manager had been appointed to the customs running of the airport, and that person didn't appreciate the significance of the covert unit and had made it clear, nothing untoward about it. It was just, I don't see the value of this unit, and we'll go back to general duties. And so the officer who asked me to prepare the reports with an eye to showing that the border security unit could do work that no other officers or no other unit could do.
This is 2002. I think you're writing this, you're collating this, these reports. What did you show in these reports that were so shocking?
Well, in relation to terrorism, what the public should understand is that the so-called screening that you go through, the whole, you know, taking off your shoes, your belt, you getting rid of your nail clippers, all that sort of thing, that is purely for PR purposes. In 40 years, there has never been a single terrorist ever stopped anywhere in the world at one of those screening units. It's like losing your wallet in George Street and looking for it in Pitt Street because the light's better in Pitt Street. It's to be seen to be doing something, no matter how ineffectual or even counterproductive, as I believe it is.
It's theatre, then, you're saying?
It's pure theatre. And extremely costly theatre, both in terms of money and civil liberties. It is absolutely counterproductive because it simply means that the true terrorist is going to use another method, of which there are many.
If they'd taken the box cutters off those hijackers, though, September 11 never would have happened, would it?
That's a good example of why the screening didn't work. There was screening in those units, and it simply did not work. The one thing that has been done since 9/11 is the armouring of the cockpit door. That is the only thing that will ever stop a hijacking. It won't stop the destruction of a plane in the air, but it will stop a hijacking per se. But they've known that for 40 years, and it was never done because of the cost factor.
So that was part of your report. You were saying that this is all meaningless theatre that we're going through when we walk through the machine.
No. That's simply my personal opinion. No, my report simply showed that the Customs Act was not being adhered to in any number of ways, either through poor procedure, poor following of laid-down rules, and the nature of the staff employed.
Who did you present that report to?
As is customary in most civil service jobs, you give it to your senior officer, who then presents it up the line.
What happened to your report?
Well, the first one, which was on private security staff, these are the people you actually see doing the bag checks, that was just rejected out of hand, and it was quite...
What do you mean, it wasn't ignored, it was rejected? It was someone said,
suppressed.
This just isn't true.
Just suppressed. And when we said why, they said, well, you know, it'll cost too much to implement. One of the recommendations was that the staff be properly screened and properly trained. And although they are wearing the uniform of a private security firm, you'll find the vast majority, at the time anyway, I can't speak for now, but at the time, the vast majority of those staff were actually subcontracted and sometimes sub-subcontracted.
Now, sorry, just to be clear, initially I was talking about this kind of collating you were doing there on in your initial report. Subsequent to that, you were asked to prepare another report.
Correct.
Into the private security staff that are employed by the airports, the corporation,
right,
as
yes.
It was at the time. Was that part of your finding in that further report then?
No, they were unrelated in as much as it wasn't my primary focus when I was doing the collating of the material gathered previously. However, it did show the vulnerability. And the first report that I was asked to produce specifically for handing on was based upon the fact that, well, this is the most obvious and blatant example of poor procedure.
So even though they said to you that this is too expensive to implement, we just won't want to do this, you were then asked to prepare a further report on these private security stuff.
By the officer who'd asked me to do the other work, yes.
And what did you find?
Well,
you tell me you found, I suppose, is a better way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an awful lot I can't tell you, unfortunately. The point about the first report was it was limited to a specific group, and that was one of the criticisms used in rejecting it. They said, oh, look, this is only this group. It is not a widespread problem, you know, and then it'll cost too much, so please go away and stop making a noise. So then my senior officer said, right, well, let's just do across the board. And so I basically just took a cross-section of everybody who held an ASIC card, that is the Air Security Identification Card, which allows any worker to move into the sterile areas. Now, a sterile area is everywhere the public doesn't see. And that includes everybody from the cleaners to the baggage handlers, the aircraft engineers, the people who come in from the outside purely to clean aircraft. Now, they're a separate group again. Only a couple of weeks ago, there was quite a large cocaine bust using those people. Now, I didn't even concentrate on a group. I just took a cross-section of everybody, and the statistical analysis, that was quite frightening in the type of people employed, the failures to enforce procedures, as I say, and just the blatant criminality.
When your report was subsequently published in newspapers, it did point to people working in the sterile areas with criminal backgrounds.
This is true.
Systemic criminality, in fact, was the phrase that was used at the time. So once you prepared these three really shocking reports, and once they were presented to the higher-ups subsequent to that, the first one was rejected out of hand, you say it was too expensive. What happened after you presented these more specific and tightly focused reports?
Absolutely nothing.
What were you told? Were they said, thanks for this, see you later? Was that what they said, or did they say, we can't do anything with this?
Both that and please stop doing this sort of thing. And each time the reason given was the most banal and reprehensible of all, the sheer commercial cost to the privatised airport corporation and Qantas. See, most people don't realise that Qantas tends to employ most of the baggage handlers, although they handle baggage for all aircraft. There are very tightly organised groups within most or all airports that I'm aware of, and there is so much going on. It would be impossible to stop criminality, but it is not impossible to stop terrorist or terrorist-type activity or the vulnerability. But that would involve much, much greater control, which costs money and costs resources.
How much penny pinching goes on at airports that you're aware of?
Sometimes it's something as pathetic as not replacing fluorescent tubes when they blow out, or those moving walkways. Sometimes they shut them down for hours on end simply to save money. I mean, honestly, it is as silly as that. It is not cleaning the carpet so that when you're walking, you find, gee, I'm sticking to this carpet. Every possible penny pinching method is used, because when I say they're shopping centres with runways attached, the point is the privatised airport corporations they make their money not so much from aircraft fees, so they make their money from the retail rents. And the retailers seem prepared to pay these high rents because of the passing parade. I think in the case of Sydney, they're getting 40,000 people going out and 40,000 people coming in every day. And these are by definition highly cashed up people because they're international travellers. And it's a quid pro quo, you know, we'll pay the high rent, but we want the traffic. If there was any attempt to properly enforce the Customs Act and regulations, then the traffic would slow down somewhat, and we can't be having with that.
So that's how the interests of commercial traders within the airport can actually come into conflict with security.
This is true. I will say the commercial entities within the airport have their own security procedures, but that is entirely concerned with their own stock shrinkage, as the phrase is. They have nothing to do with security per se, such as in terrorism. Their procedures are designed to protect their commercial interests. But the airport corporation has responsibility for the overall security, as in terror security.
So, Alan, what you're saying to me at the moment is you presented these reports, but really it wasn't going to go anywhere because you'd become a bit of a nuisance, because essentially you were giving out information that suggested that money would have to be spent, quite a bit of money, and that would interfere with the corporation's bottom line.
That's correct. That's probably why the covert unit was being given such heavy scrutiny, because its day-to-day existence was a blatant
nuisance.
Yeah.
A nuisance.
Simple as that.
Was there any sense at the time that this would create political difficulties?
No, because it never went anywhere. This is the whole point.
Did anyone ever say to you, this better not get out?
Yes. Many people said that on many occasions.
What was the effect of then, if the fact that your report had been shelved? These reports, important reports, had been shelved. Was that known amongst your fellow officers?
Amongst the covert unit it was, of course.
And what view did they take?
Unimpressed.
You understating things a little bit?
Just a wee bit, yes. It was a constant. A day didn't go by that there wasn't a robust discussion within the office, but most customs officers didn't know this unit existed, so it was not something we ever discussed outside.
Were they making representations to your senior officers saying that this is an outrage, some of these reports need to be acted upon?
My senior officer, who asked me to prepare the reports, constantly brought it up at various meetings and was constantly slapped down.
Constantly slapped down. How long afterwards was your unit then disbanded?
Well, by then I was long past retirement age, and I'd only stayed on longer than I needed to complete these reports because I felt they were just so important. So having presented the final major report in, I think it was September 2003, and not unexpectedly seeing it, suppressed, rejected, buried, whatever you want to call it, I announced my intention of retiring. I took my long service leave and went away, and I came back at the end of 2004. In the meantime, I'd been advised by colleagues who kept in touch that during my absence, the unit had been disbanded, and two officers had resigned. Two officers from that covert unit had resigned, and the other officers returned to general duties.
Were you being urged by your fellow officers to leak this report?
No. But the senior officer involved was the most concerned, and as I said, the topic was brought up at management meetings, operational meetings, call them what you will, and been constantly told to can it. But it was a topic of conversation which never went away. And when I returned to duty in 2005, I found it was still as big a topic as when I went away, a year previously. And as when the Chappelle Corby matter blew up, that's when my fellow officers who remained were just, beyond distraction. They
disgusted.
That's a very mild term. Yeah, absolutely.
Distressed.
Well, they were certainly disgusted and ashamed, basically, to think that, this material had been available and they were constrained from letting, the world know that we knew perfectly well that conditions were not what they should be in the airports. And honestly, it was the constant discussion was so bad that I actually took to avoiding the other officers who remained because we could not get together without, within seconds returning to this topic, especially because of the Chappelle Corby matter. It was something that we were just so shocked, so ashamed, so furious at the distortions that were, there's no other word for it, the lies that were being put out about the official. I think it was the AFP Commissioner Keelty said, there is no evidence of criminality amongst the baggage handlers at Sydney Airport.
Wait a minute, you'd specified evidence of criminal activity in your reports.
In 2003.
Do you know if he had your reports, if Keelty had your reports,
now,
when he said that?
Now, this is the point. At that time, although I knew unofficially that, of course, they did have them, it was not confirmed until I went on trial in 2007, so we're now talking 4 years after the event. At my trial, there was testimony given, on oath, that the contents of my reports had been uploaded into the AFP Intel system in December 2004. So when those statements were made about no knowledge of corruption amongst baggage handlers, it was...
Wrong?
Yes, wrong.
Were you in conversations with your former colleagues then?
When we just simply met during general duties. And as I say, it became such a mania with some of them that I took to avoiding them because what more can you say? If those reports had been acted upon, the situation would never have arisen. Now that it had arisen and the information was not being... I don't know how to put this without opening up...
further legally complicated avenues for yourself.
But it was well known I think as you had Andrew Wilkie on recently, and he said it was well known within his department that there were no WMDs, and it was also well known that the politicians were lying and misrepresenting the facts to the public. Well, that was exactly the case with Schapelle Corby. The information was widely known within the various customs and AFP, and they were denying it.
Are you saying then that the government was acting on the advice they'd received from Mick Keelty when they were making those statements about security at the airport?
That would be the nicest way of putting it. I do not understand how they were able to make the statements they made.
You're surprised how confident they were? Confident these statements were about the integrity of our customs processes?
Well, I don't know that they were all that confident. If you read the actual wording, this is tendentious mendacity. If you actually read the statements, they are not saying what they seem to mean. If you read the actual words, like there was one quote by, I think it was Keelty, he said something like, there is very little evidence of smuggling between domestic airports. Now, if you parse that, if there is very little evidence, ipso facto, there is some evidence. He then went on to say, now, but this is the same statement, he then went on to say, there is no evidence of a link with the Corby matter. But that doesn't mean there isn't any. It means simply you have no evidence. Well, why don't you go out and do some investigation and find the evidence?
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Former customs officer Alan Kessing is my guest in conversation today. Was it around about this time you took your report to Anthony Albanese, who was your local member?
This was in April, early April.
He was at that
2005.
Stage a Labor opposition frontbencher in those days.
He was actually the shadow minister for transport.
What did he say when you gave him these reports, saying, which essentially said the government and Mick Keelty are wrong when they're talking about the integrity of our customs processes?
We'll look into it.
And did he?
I was advised that they would not be doing anything further about it.
Was he interested in what you had to say?
It certainly seemed the way at the time.
He had an opportunity here to majorly embarrass the government.
Or maybe do something. Never mind embarrass the government. You see, I don't like...
Sorry, I'm ascribing, of course, political motives to a politician. I'm sorry. But
I would rather this wasn't on a partisan level. I would rather the principle be addressed. And the principle is we had the information. The information was suppressed for the most banal and you know, worthless reasons, i.e. commercial costs, when somebody's life was at stake, basically.
He did nothing with your reports then, that's aware of?
That's correct.
Do you have a view on why he did nothing?
I have my own views, but they're merely my personal views. I cannot understand why nothing was done when other information, which he specifically asked me for other information, which I, you know, was able to give him from, you know, basically public sources. There was nothing unusual about that. And that information was used by other members of his party in Senate estimates. And at one time, you'll find this in the Hansard transcripts. I think it was Senator Ludwig at the time was questioning Lionel Woodward, who was the CEO of Customs. And Woodward actually said, well, obviously your information is better than mine. I'm afraid I can't answer that question.
Well, and that was that. That's it, is it?
It was never answered. It was about the failure of the cargo automation scheme at the end of 2005. I and a few others warned that that system would collapse the moment it was implemented, and it did. Within hours, the system had collapsed, and in the end, they were actually having to find old officers who knew how to do the paper system of clearance for the next 6 weeks because the mighty computer system had broken down.
It was around about this time that your mum got sick, Alan. How did you find out she was ill?
Well, it was one of those horrible coincidences. The day I arrived back from my long service leave, I stopped in at her place. She lives quite near the airport. Went to bed that night, got up the next morning, and, how are you? Haven't seen you for nearly a year. Well, actually, I'm feeling a little bit off. And, let's go to the doctor. And went to the doctor, and... 2 days later, she was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and died 6 months later.
So you were looking after her this whole time?
Yeah.
The story of your reports was published in The Australian. What did you think when you saw that in the paper?
I didn't see it in the paper. I was woken up by the 6 a.m. news broadcasts. They were all going utterly mad about it. And my first thought was, given the fairly long lead-in time of most journalists or reports in newspapers, all I could think of was, you published this now, and that was on May 31st. I think Schapelle Corby was sentenced on May 27. My first thought was, why didn't you publish this, you know, even a week or two ago before the trial finished? And my second thought was, if only my reports had been implemented when they were written back in 2002 and 2003, this tragedy would never have occurred, never have occurred.
You went to Anthony Albanese with your information, but you've always maintained it was not you that leaked that information to the journalists from Australian.
Till the day I die, I will maintain that.
So there was some degree of surprise then?
No, not really.
You had some intimation that this might happen?
That's correct.
The government denied any knowledge of the information in your reports once it was put out in front of the whole wide world. Did you believe that at the time?
Well, I didn't have time to disbelieve it because they changed their story the next day and then the day after that and the day after that.
How did the story change?
Well, the first comment was there was no such report. This is a beat up.
It didn't exist.
The second day it was, this was a minor report of no significance. The third day, I think it was John Anderson, who at the time was Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Transport, resigned to spend more time with his family. And on the fourth day, Ellison, who was the Minister for Customs, announced that there would be an inquiry. And on the Tuesday following, less than a week later, Howard had announced that it would be Sir John Wheeler looking in. I think the phrase was, because of public concern over security at Sydney Airport, we are appointing Sir John Wheeler to look into this. Well, the only reason there was public concern is because these reports had been brought to the public awareness, and yet they'd been written 2 years previously.
Did you speak to Sir John Wheeler during that inquiry?
No. Customs officers weren't allowed to speak to him.
Did he want to speak to you? No. Are you aware of that?
I was never approached. I was retired by then, but...
Why weren't you allowed? Why weren't customs officers allowed to speak to a man conducting an inquiry?
Because that would be breaching Section 70 of the Crimes Act, under which I was charged.
But he was commissioned by the federal government to write a report. I mean...
But it's an axiom of politics that you never establish an inquiry until you know the answer. And the terms of reference mean that no customs officer was called, apart from the CEO, of course.
Did he ask to see the reports you wrote into Sydney Airport Security?
He did, and he was not allowed to see them at first, and this was widely reported at the time. And he basically threatened to stop the inquiry and go away unless he had access to those reports.
The ones that didn't exist then?
The ones that didn't exist, and then they were minor reports, and then they were of no significance, blah, 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 blah.
And what did he find in the end? How similar was it to your findings?
Well, he endorsed everything in my reports and made a series of recommendations, some of which I had made, some of which were more wide-reaching. And the Howard government promised $200 million to implement them, which doesn't seem to have quite happened as smartly as one might have hoped, because I saw some announcement only, I think it was last year, that there is now 100% coverage by CCTV of Brisbane Domestic Airport, but that was recommended in 2005. It takes you 4 years to get something like that together. There was the bikey fight at Sydney Domestic Airport. The same thing, the same problems arose in stopping it. There was no joined-up policing. The various authorities, state police, AFP and so on, couldn't communicate. They were on different radio. All these things were addressed by both myself and Wheeler. The CCTV, none of which had been implemented 4 years after the Wheeler report. These things just go on. When I speak to my ex-colleagues...
What's at the bottom of this? Is this sheer incompetence or penny-pinching? I mean, the government's made this money available, haven't they? I mean...
Well, that's what they reported. That's what was reported in the newspaper. But when I ask my ex-colleagues, they say, well, apart from a couple of spiffy new titles for some senior officers, we detect no difference. And in fact, I think Senator Nick Xenophon asked in Senate estimates a couple of years ago now which of the recommendations of the Wheeler report had been implemented, and there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, and the best that they could come up with was there are 3 monthly meetings of the new Office of Air Transport Security. Whee! Isn't that wonderful? 3 monthly meetings.
How did you realise you were under surveillance by the Australian Federal Police?
Because they were sitting outside my mother's house in a car.
While you were caring for your mother?
Yeah.
And they were easy to spot?
Well, put it this way, I was born and brought up in that street in inner city Sydney, Marrickville. My mother had lived there for over 50 years. She knew everybody in the street and all her neighbours. it was a topic of conversation. Who are these dorks sitting in the car there?
Did you go up and say hello at any point?
I didn't bother with that. I sort of waved them as I go out the door, and that was pathetic. These are sworn statements by them, by the way. In the brief of evidence, it was presented to my defence but never brought up in court. One of them said, "I followed Mr. Kessing to the local library. He then browsed the CD racks and read newspapers for an hour. He then went on the computers and accessed news sites." This went on, according to the brief of evidence, for over 6 months. My telephones were tapped. They were looking over my shoulder when I was sitting in... I didn't own a computer at the time. That's why I used the local library computer. Looking over my shoulder when I was reading news sites. And the sum total of all this surveillance was absolutely zero.
So you were the number one suspect for having leaked your own reports, but as far as they were concerned, to The Australian?
No. We know now that I wasn't. Put it this way, though. If I'd been investigating the situation, I would have picked at least myself and a couple of others. So I was not in the least surprised. I mean, I thought, oh, well, you know, at least you're on the ball. But then I realised they weren't.
They found evidence that you had the contact details of one of the journalists.
That's correct.
And yeah, they'd found phone records that there'd been phone conversations between you and the office of The Australian.
The switchboard of The Australian, yes. But as my solicitor pointed out, we don't know what these conversations were. It could have been complaining about, you know, non-delivery of a subscription. The Crown at my trial actually opened and closed the prosecution case by saying this is entirely circumstantial evidence. We have no hard evidence. We have no... Well, I was never questioned by any authorities. I've never been... The only words I've ever said officially about this whole matter were "not guilty" twice, because it was seen that the case was so weak and so circumstantial that it was just otiose. There was no point my testifying. The point about our advocacy system is it's an accusatory system. It is not like in the Code Napoleon in Europe, where you have to prove your innocence. Under our system, the Crown must make an accusation and must prove it. The accused is under no obligation to make any response. It must be proved. You need not prove your innocence. And it just seemed to my legal counsel that it was just so pathetic that there was no point. I've never been interrogated. I've never been asked questions. I've never actually even arrested officially. This all went through...
Wait a minute, you were never arrested?
No.
How were you charged?
Well, you see, this is what is so Kafkaesque about it. When people talk about the, you know, Kafkaesque, the Franz Kafka books, they tend to think it's about... Well, the trial is a good example. But they tend to think it's about a malevolent state. But it's not actually. That's a misreading. It's about an uncaring, rumbling behemoth. And in fact, the very first lines in the trial by Kafka is...
Somebody had been telling lies about Joseph K.
I could not believe it when I read that, because one morning, for a reason he didn't understand, he was under... Yeah, arrest. But I was never arrested. I only ever had bits of paper shoved, you know, through the letterbox.
What were you actually charged with?
The indictment specified that I was charged with releasing, providing information to two named journalists without authorisation. Now, those named journalists were not even called as witnesses. And when the judge asked the Crown why they weren't being called, the Crown equivocated a bit. And basically the judge said, well, look, I think, you know, they need to be subpoenaed.
Now, here we come to some interesting facets of the trial that you went through. Subpoenas were issued for the journalists. By the Crown. Were they ever enforced?
No. And 1 week later, when His Honour said to the Crown, well, it's been a week, the subpoenas have not been responded to, we shall now seek enforcement. Crown said, no, I have been ordered by my superior officer not to seek enforcement of these subpoenas. Now, a subpoena is the most powerful instrument we have in our judicial system. I defy anybody, any legal student out there, to find one example in the last 100-odd years where the Crown has issued a subpoena for a fairly vital witness and has not then enforced that subpoena.
Was the thinking that if we actually enforce this subpoena and bring these News Limited journalists before the court, they'll inevitably be asked who the source was for the story and they'll have to refuse to answer it? Because that's the journalistic code of ethics. You don't name your sources. I mean, did they take the view that it would be a pointless activity?
No, I think they were more afraid of You see, as you say, they wouldn't say who was your source, but they would have been able to say something along the lines of, is this your source? And if they said no, you know, a collapse of Stout Party and failure of the trial. I think that's why they... You see, there was an... As we've now learned with the recent publication of a letter from 2005, of which I, you know, my defence was not aware, and there were other suspects, and this was not divulged to the court.
I want to come to that in just a moment first, because there's another irregularity here that's... Well, I don't know if you call it an irregularity, but it's an interesting facet of your trial. Before the jury retired, they were ordered by the judge to disregard the public interest aspect of the case, Alan.
This is correct, because it was of no relevance in the judge's opinion.
I suppose that strictly adheres to the Crimes Act, doesn't it?
That's correct. The indictment specified without authorisation. Now, there was a Privy Council ruling in 1967, and at the time we were still subject to the Privy Council. Lord Denning, Master of the Rolls, who was a crotchety old chap, but he certainly knew the law, he made a ruling that a servant is under no obligation to cover up the criminality of their master.
You wrote a report which did not allege criminal activity on behalf of your superiors.
No.
So that doesn't apply in this case then, does it?
No, but the you mentioned public interest, and in the indictment it said without authorisation. Well, that is a moot point, because authorisation, is there a higher authorisation, i.e. to the commonweal rather than one's master, which is the point of the Lord Denning ruling. The fact that those reports were suppressed was surely wrong, as was demonstrated by the amazing speed with which the Wheeler report was instituted and the promise to spend the money. So they are, by definition, saying that the suppression of those reports was wrong.
There is the argument that can be made, which is that governments need to keep secrets. They need to withhold information on security procedures specifically.
I would agree with that.
You'd agree with that?
Absolutely.
And if we allowed people who do have access to those secrets to, or any kind of information, to release it willy-nilly like that, that would leave governments very, very naked all the time. So, I mean, where do you want to draw the line on this, I suppose, when it comes to the release of information of a sensitive nature?
Well, even in what you just said then, releasing willy-nilly, no responsible whistleblower ever does that. And as Andrew Wilkie made clear, and as any number of whistleblowers have made clear in the past, and any number of reports, I mean, A.J. Brown, Professor A.J. Brown of Griffith University, released a report, and he said in no case that he was able to research was it ever a vindictive or other lesser motive by a whistleblower. It was always after much heart-searching and for the common benefit. And this is the distinction which must always be made between a whistleblower and somebody who has a grudge. And I am very much in favour of necessary secrecy, but the necessary secrets of governments are very, very few and far between, and the vast majority are merely to save embarrassment. Now, every opposition, in whether it's America or Britain or Australia, when they're in opposition, they're fully in favour of freedom of information. And when they get into power, no matter what country it is, they suddenly forget about it. And why would any government want freedom of information? Because it merely exposes them their incompetence. And all governments, by definition, must have failings, and nobody wants their failings brought out. So I'm certainly in favour of security, and I'm certainly in favour of governments maintaining secrets, but there's a difference between a necessary secret and to save political embarrassment. And the vast majority of leaks which are justified are purely political embarrassment.
Meanwhile, the identity of the person who you say had leaked your reports was in your mind. Were you ever tempted to produce that name?
Never. I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing.
So you had been then... The jury had been sent away, and the judge had ordered them not to take the public interest aspect into account. The jury returned after some difficulty with a guilty verdict. Then it's...
Three and a half days. And 22 questions.
Then the Crown argued that your sentence should include time in jail because you had, quote, embarrassed the government.
Interesting concept, isn't it? And also as a warning to other civil servants. That was part of the Crown submission because they'd embarrassed the government and as a warning to other civil servants.
The judge gave you a suspended sentence, but it means you still today have a criminal record then.
This is correct. I can't stand for Parliament, for instance, which I very much wanted to at the last election.
Now, recently, a letter has surfaced. What's in that letter, Alan?
Well, much to my unastonishment, it basically was a letter from the Internal Affairs of Customs giving the case over to the AFP and outlining the facts and basically saying that, well, not saying in so many words, there are at least two sources for the reports which appeared in The Australian.
So during the course of the investigation by the AFP, they received this letter from Customs.
This was the letter from Customs to the AFP initiating the AFP's investigation. Customs had already carried out their own investigation.
This is obviously a critical bit of evidence in the case.
I would have thought so, a lot of legal opinion since the publication of this letter have also agreed with that.
Was this letter from Customs that was handed to the AFP ever shown to either the Crown prosecuting your case or your lawyers?
My lawyers certainly not. According to reports in the paper in the last 2 weeks, the AFP has said that they did not disclose this letter to the Director of Public Prosecutions.
Do you believe that?
You have to believe what the AFP says, don't you?
Why has this only surfaced now?
Yeah, it's funny that. I've often made the point that... See, bear in mind, I've worked with the AFP in my previous job when I was writing the reports, for instance, because I had access to their various systems and Department of Immigration. It was a bit of an embarrassment. At least two officers of the AFP refused to be involved in this case.
What do you think will be the ramifications then, the fact that evidence was apparently withheld, from the very least, from your own lawyers?
What I want is a full inquiry. There's no two ways. I've always said, if it were a choice between being pardoned, which you must acknowledge your guilt to seek a pardon, I'm highly reluctant to do that. I would much rather a full inquiry into the circumstances of the way the investigation was handled, the inordinate length of time that the trial took. See, bear in mind that between my being raided and being brought to trial was 2 years. And even after the trial, you must lodge an appeal within 30 days. It took over a year to obtain the transcripts of my trial in order to lodge the appeal. Every step along the way, my case, or the way this case has been handled, has breached rule after rule after convention after procedure. That alone, I think, bears looking at. And there are some groups which have said they will look at that, the Innocence Project being one of them.
So just to stand back for a moment, and seeing how this has unfolded over time, this is how then it would seem, the facts would seem to be, Alan. You wrote several reports within Customs pointing at major holes in security within Customs in Sydney Airport. Nothing was done with those reports. These reports were leaked to a newspaper. The publishing of these reports led to a public outcry, denial that the reports existed, and then eventually an inquiry into the airports was then conducted by a British bureaucrat into the whole thing. Then you were fingered as the main leaker of these documents by the federal police. The Crown brought a case against you, and eventually you were found guilty. Throughout this process, evidence being withheld from lawyers, questions not being asked, juries being directed in certain ways... This is a very, very strange thing to have unfolded. What does this cost you financially?
Well, it cost me my entire superannuation payout.
Can you put a figure on that?
About $100,000.
In legal fees?
Yes. I received $72,000 as my superannuation payout, which meant that when I sought legal aid to begin with, I couldn't obtain it because I had $72,000 from the superannuation. And once that had gone, the only way one could get legal aid was to cover future expenses, so that was gone and lost. And after the failure of the Court of Appeal, which would also have been influenced by this so-called missing letter, and I believe there are some others still to emerge in the newspaper.
There's more letters to come.
This is what I believe. So I'm just fascinated to know what they'll include. And I was then determined to go on to the High Court, but I basically ran out of money. I had no means to take this case to the High Court. Now, I was told by my barrister at the time that the case couldn't fail to succeed, which is an interesting juxtaposition, but that was the way they put it. But suddenly my barrister wasn't available when the High Court date was made. And that was the end of it. I had no more money left. I couldn't even hire another barrister.
Governments govern by telling us a story. They create a narrative. You know, journalists are always saying, the government's got to create a narrative on this. They create a grand narrative. If someone comes forward and presents solid information that just says that narrative is plain wrong, that makes you a very dangerous person to the government, doesn't it?
Yes, but equally, we must remember the attention span of the politician and the public, and it has been decreasing dramatically in recent years. And the way I look at it is the dogs have barked and the caravan has moved on. The mere fact that you've heard nothing about this for the last 18 months is because it's of no interest to anybody anywhere except me, and even I've got over it.
How about the different federal government now? Are they showing any interest in pursuing this at all?
None whatsoever. When you consider the wonderful support they gave me when they were in opposition, there was any number of statements from both Kevin Rudd, the current Attorney General, Mr. McClelland, half a dozen, Senator Ludwig issued a statement. There was all sorts of statements in support of both me and the need for reform of the freedom of information laws and whistleblowing laws. They were wonderfully in support when they were in opposition.
As you mentioned, Andrew Wilkie was on the program recently talking about, he told us he's now, of course, in federal parliament and is in the process of drafting new whistleblower laws with the ALP's Gary Gray, and he seemed to speak about that quite optimistically. Are you optimistic about new whistleblower laws, particularly if they're drafted by a whistleblower? Well, in consultation with a whistleblower like Andrew Wilkie himself.
Well, I was more impressed by Mark Dreyfus, who was a very high-profile QC before he was elected to Parliament in 2007, I think it was, and he was tasked with preparing a report on the reform of the whistleblowing laws. It took him 18 months, and he finally gave his report, I think it was February, March 2009, and since when we've heard precisely nothing. The report that he put forward was rather weak because it said you had to go through certain procedures, such as you must, you know, if you think a decision is wrong, you appeal it to your superior, your senior. Well, given that it's almost always the superior who buries anything, that's a pretty pointless exercise. But I suppose, you know, a crumb is better than no loaf at all. I won't even call it half a loaf. It's I am not holding my breath, shall we put it that way, because, as I said earlier, it is not in the interest of any government, of any party. This is nothing. There's nothing partisan about this. No government wants open government, as Sir Humphrey used to say. Why would you?
You're saying you want an inquiry. What do you want for yourself? You don't want a pardon, do you?
I'd rather the truth came out. That's all I want, is for this matter to be investigated thoroughly. All the elisions, all the failures, all the odd circumstances, and outright perjury. There are some examples where, and the thing is, when I used to sit there at my trial and look over at the prosecution, they had these two huge trolleys, like hand trolleys, and there must have been 60, you know, arch lever folders there with, you know, information gained during the investigation. And when you think of what was presented, there was a conga line of customs officers, and they all said the same thing: "It weren't me, mister." And the really bizarre thing, I thought, was they brought in the head of every department in customs from Canberra. Now, this is border security, drugs enforcement, passenger control, terrorism. The head of every one of those departments said the same thing: "I was not aware of the existence of these reports until they appeared in the newspaper." Now, that's true. That is exactly the point. They were not aware. Why isn't that the issue? The fact that these reports were suppressed, not just rejected but suppressed, and the heads of department who should have known and clearly did want to know, because they were pretty annoyed when it came out, were not made aware. This is an issue in and of itself. Never mind me. You know, I'm just an individual. Why is the system so... Why does the system work so badly, shall we say?
And finally, the role of the Australian Federal Police in this. The picture you're painting at the moment is of a federal police that, you know, withheld information from your defence lawyers.
So it appears.
So it would appear. Who conducted surveillance upon you, whose enforcement of the Crimes Act seem to be so specific and intense. The picture you're painting, it would seem, is the federal police responding to the political needs of the government of the day. You'd created great embarrassment in the eyes of the government. Therefore, something had to be done. Is that a fair picture?
That is absolutely accurate. And you see, the AFP, especially in the Howard years, acted more as a Praetorian guard. The Australian Federal Police are there to enforce crimes against the Commonwealth. However, during the previous government, in their function as a Praetorian Guard, that is, their only loyalty was to the Emperor, not to the citizenry of ancient Rome. And I suggest it was somewhat the same in our case, that the political embarrassment, they had to find somebody. But what I said earlier about the dogs that barked and the caravan moved on, the political embarrassment passed. It was gone. It was finished. Wheeler came and went. Nobody even could remember it 6 months later, and yet I wasn't actually brought to trial until 2 years later. Nobody cared. It wasn't reported. It was of no consequence. But the bureaucratic machine, once set in motion, nobody bothered to tell it to stop. And this is where I think we have a problem, that it's been well pointed out that the really nasty people in, say, the Nazi regime or anything else, Hannah Arendt called it the banality of evil. It was merely, these were little functionaries who had no thought of their own but were happy to implement the most appalling regime. Similarly now, whether it's in the Dr. Death scandal in Queensland, or any number of bureaucratic failures, it is always about the functionaries simply obeying orders. And at Nuremberg, that was found to be an insufficient defence. And I think the problem is any organisation, whether it's a commercial organisation or a government, once they get beyond a certain size, more and more of the resources are committed to protecting the structures of that organisation and not to carrying out the ostensible purpose. And in the case of law enforcement agencies, that is doubly or trebly so, because they have more to hide than most large organisations simply because of the nature of their work.
It'd be great to catch up with you again in a couple of years and see how things have progressed since then, because we'll keep a watching brief on your story. Thank you so much for being my guest in Conversation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.